Morning, everyone. I'd like to take you to Psalm chapter 3 today. Psalm 3, as I mentioned, I expect we'll be jumping around a good bit this year. I finished Colossians last week, and Psalm 3 today, this psalm is a lament. Now, biblical laments, of course, are prayers of sorrow. They are prayers that you pray when the world is not working the way that it's supposed to, and you're saying, what do I do with this? How do I make sense of this? And I think that biblical laments are an underused, underappreciated category of praying, of writing in the Bible. They are found perhaps most concentrated in the prophets and the wisdom literature, the Psalms like this one, but really they're all throughout the Bible. And what I want to do today is I want to just give you a few of the characteristics of lament before I do the reading, because I think that if you hear these characteristics ahead of time, you'll recognize them when I go through the chapter, and you'll be able to appreciate and have a greater apprehension of what you're about to hear. So a few of the characteristics of lament, there's a man named Tremper Longman who's done a good bit of writing on these. He says there are seven characteristics. They're not in every lament, but most of them are in most laments, and they can be found in any particular order usually. Laments typically, somewhere in them, have an invocation. An invocation is simply a fancy way of saying you're calling on God. You're calling out God's name. So the laments are addressed to God. That's the first piece, calling out of God's name. Second, laments typically have a plea to God. There is something that you're asking God to do, asking God to give you deliverance or to make some provision in the midst of what you're facing. So invocation, plea. Third, there will be a complaint. Now this is the first piece that many Christians today can be uncomfortable with. Aren't we supposed to not complain, not grumble? We can be uncomfortable with this, but the complaint really is the focus of the prayer. That's why you're lamenting. Something's wrong, right? Something's not the way that it's supposed to be. And so there's a complaint that the psalmist, the lamenter, is bringing to God. Fourth, there will often be either a confession of wrongdoing. Okay, I did this wrong, so this is happening to me. I'm confessing it. Can you take this away now? There will either be a confession of wrongdoing or an assertion of innocence, an assertion of righteousness. And this can be the second piece that Christians are uncomfortable with, because no one's righteous? No one is perfectly without fault. And so important to know, whenever you find these assertions of innocence, they're generally not absolute claims. I've never ever sinned, but the lamenter is saying, I never did anything to deserve this that's happening. And so there's an assertion of innocence. Fifth, there will then also often be, and this is the final piece that many Christians are uncomfortable with, understandably so, there will often be a cursing of one's enemies. Fancy name for it is an imprecation, calling on God to smite those who are causing this situation, those who are doing the opposing, calling down curses on one's enemies. We'll talk about a little bit about how to wrestle with that or handle that. Sixth, there will be, and this part's amazing, there will be an expression of confidence in God. In the midst of everything else that's going on, yet I will trust you. Yet I place my faith in you. I believe you. I am confident in you in spite of, in the midst of everything that I'm looking at with my own two physical eyes, confidence in God, as you see there on your bulletin, the title for today. And then finally, the laments often, not always, but very often conclude with a hymn or a blessing. And this too is amazing. A blessing of God's name, praise to him, or praying for, believing in, expressing blessing on God's people. And these last two sections, the confidence and the blessing, these are why the book of Psalms is not a depressing book, even though it's filled with laments. There's lamentation the whole way through the book of Psalms, but you don't read it and say, oh, this, what a downer. You read Psalms and you get uplifted. You experience hope because in the midst of all of those sorrows and all that confusion, the psalmists maintain confidence in God and end with, you have turned my sorrow into joy, praise, and blessing. And that's what we want to experience for ourselves today as well. How can he take all of our uncertainty, all of our fears, and turn them around, convert them into prayers of adoration and blessing? So we're going to hear today, we're going to focus in on three of those seven. You won't hear all seven of those pieces in today's reading, but you'll hear most of them. You'll hear quite a few. And the three that we're going to focus in on the most are, one, David's complaint, two, David's confidence in God, and then three, David's chorus at the end. Verses 1 and 2, the complaint, 3 through 6, his expression of confidence, and then 7 through 8, his chorus. Let's listen and read together Psalm chapter 3. A psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. O Lord, invocation. I won't identify all of them as we go, but there's the invocation. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. Selah. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. Selah. Just an expression of pause there, or peace. Verse 5. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God. For you strike all my enemies on the cheek, you break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. Selah. This is the word of the Lord. First, David's complaint. David starts off with that invocation, O Lord, and then bam, he goes right into the complaint. There's no beating around the bush in this particular psalm. O Lord, how many are my foes? How many are rising up against me? How many are saying of me, there's no help for him? God's abandoned him. God's not going to save him. O Lord, how many are my foes? Now, right off the bat, that gives us a very important lesson. In these psalms, in these laments, the speaker is taking all of his concerns and he is bringing them to God. You notice he's not just venting to other people. He's not just rambling and grumbling and complaining to anybody who will listen. No, it's a very directed thing. It's a very deliberate act. He is taking his complaint, but he is bringing them to God. Now, you see, we have one of two errors often in modern tendencies. We make one of two different mistakes. The one is we as good modern Christian people, we say, well, you should not have those negative feelings. Right? You shouldn't have that. You shouldn't say that. How many are my foes, oh God? David, you're not supposed to complain, right? We can have a tendency in Christian circles to repress negative feelings, stuff them down, pretend like they're not in there. That's the one error. The error on the other side is just wallow in those negative expressions. Just vent them. Just let them come gushing out at whoever's around you, and you have no aimed way of dealing with them. And just sort of let your feelings be what they are and never challenge them. One of two errors, and the biblical pattern, biblical men don't do either of those. They don't pretend like those negative feelings aren't in there, right? He's expressing them, but he's not just expressing them to anybody at all. He's saying, I'm going to take these and I'm going to bring them to God. And that's the first thing we need to do. And I would say, in fact, it's only in that. I'd say the goal is getting to where you don't have those negative complaints going on inside you. But the only way you get to where they're no longer in there is you got to take the ones that you do find and bring them out to God. And in bringing them into the light before him, you experience him changing them. You cooperate with his changing work inside of you. So you want to grow out of these negative feelings, you got to learn to complain to God first. All right, so let's look at what David is complaining about. The superscript or the title there says, A Psalm of David When He Fled from His Son Absalom. Now, do you know anything about what that event, about the event that that refers to? It's found for us in 2 Samuel chapter 15. This is one of the unusually clear background scenarios that we have with laments. Very often in biblical laments, we're left sort of piecing together various clues to try to determine what the original context was, the original scenario, but not Psalm chapter 3. Psalm chapter 3, David tells us, I'm writing this as I'm fleeing. as I'm having to run away from my throne, my kingdom. And the reason why he's having to run is his own son is coming at him. Now that's rough. I mean, it's rough. Anytime we're going to talk about a few of the challenges that we face in our day and age, but we don't have literal armies coming at us. We're not out in the hillsides. So it's rough anytime somebody is literally trying to kill you. But it's especially rough when it's your own boy, your own son. Absalom is coming at him. Reason to complain. But it's also not just Absalom. To make matters worse, it's not just his son. It's also Ahithophel. Now, I know you know the man named Ahithophel. Ahithophel was one of David's best friends. He was one of David's counselors. This is 2 Samuel 15, 10 through 12. Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes. He's staging his coup. He's organizing his rebellion against his father. Sends his secret messengers. And he says, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, proclaim, Absalom is king. Not David, Absalom is king. 200 men go with him. And we are told, while Absalom was offering sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, David's counselor. And thus the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with him kept increasing. You see, Ahithophel was a trusted counselor. It was said in those days that his words were like one speaking the very words of God. He didn't get things wrong. He had keen insight. This, if you're going to war, this is a guy you want on your side. Makes me think of Elisha in 2 Kings 6, knowing the tactics of the enemy. You're going up to battle, and the one who, it's as if he's speaking the very words of God, he switches sides from David to Absalom. This is bad news for David. The conspiracy grows in potency, in quality. They are now wiser. And with Ahithophel's betrayal, we are told many more flock to Absalom. Oh, that's the side that's going to win. And so the conspiracy grows in quantity as well as in quality. And so David says, how many are my foes? And in fact, the word there for many is the exact same Hebrew word that is used back in 2 Samuel 15 to describe the multitudes, the throngs who are going to Absalom's cause now that he has Ahithophel as well. And so by saying many, 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 look three times there, verses 1 and 2, many, many, many are rising against me. It is a way of both structuring the text, look at all the repetition, but it's also a way of hearkening back to the original situation, of expressing the original situation. David is not just stating numerical information. Gee, God, look, let's count all the different people that are coming up against me. He's not just stating information. He is evoking all of the feelings you would have if you are in the hills running away because somebody is trying to kill you. And they're getting better as they come at you. This is terror. This is panic and anxiety. As the conspiracy grows with each passing day. Now, do you know what it is to express concerns to God like that? As I say, we don't face anything quite exactly like that, thank God. But whatever concerns you do have, do you know what it is to take them to God and say, I'm not just going to deny this. I'm not just going to wallow in this. I'm going to bring it to you. In our own day, don't jump too quickly from the text to the modern era. Right, he is talking about events that occurred nearly 3,000 years ago. So don't look for ciphers or clues for current headlines in this. But once we see the principle, then it is right and appropriate to apply it to our own situation. So in our own day, there are those coming to power. There are those that are in power. All of the new advisory appointments. We would be pampered to think that we have it exactly as bad as David did. I'm not going there. We'd be spoiled to think, oh, our life is already just like what David was going through. We'd be pampered to think that, but we would also be naive to think there's no concern. Again, I'm not going into all the details today. You can look it up and do the reading of the track record of some of these cabinet appointments. But suffice it to say, there's a very clear track record that when push comes to shove and individual liberties come up against institutional religious liberties, you know which one they say has to go. In the name of the individual rights, newly discovered rights. on the other side of moral issues. And all the talk of peace and unity, it sounds great. The issue is in the follow-up actions. In fact, I believe spiritually, this has been the case for a number of years in the West. Spiritually, the tactic of the enemy has been, I'm not here. Don't worry about me. I'll let you alone. And we're just seeing that played out even more. Peace, peace, everything's fine. We're all going to be united. There's a growing threat. Not where David was at this point, but we would be naive not to recognize it. Many rising up against the people of God in potency and in quantity. Do you see it? And do you start with God about it? Do you talk to Him about it? You have concerns? Let's be more honest. Do you have complaints? Bring them to Him. He can handle them. In fact, the one who made you knows what's already going on inside there. It would be silly to pretend like it's not. He already knows it's in there. You might as well talk to Him about it. And it's only in bringing them before Him that you experience the real kind of change that we're after. So take them to Him. He can handle them. David's complaint. Second, his confidence. On the one hand, as I mentioned there in the reading, Selah likely is just a musical word of pause, of stillness, of rest. But that by itself is amazing. David is experiencing peace in the middle of his complaint. In the middle of this trial, many are rising up against me, saying these things about me. Rest. Stillness. Do you know the peace in the midst of your complaint? One thing. But beyond that, too, there's something even more amazing here. And that occurs in verse 3. You see, grammatically, verse 3 sets up a contrast. A very important word that occurs at the beginning. It introduces a change, a shift, if not in circumstances, at least in his outlook. And that shift is striking. Verse 3, many are saying these things of me, rising up against me, but you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. Many are rising against me, but you are a shield. I cried aloud to the Lord. He answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again because you sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands who have set themselves against me all around. Many are saying of me, but I say of you, you are my shield. You know that great song, "But Thou, O Lord, art a shield about me." We're going to close our service with that today. Sing it in just a minute. Many are saying this, but you are a shield about me. Now, where does that come from? I mean, it's so abrupt. Did the change in direction catch you at all as we read through that? Everything is bad, woe is me, but not woe is me, because I have you. Where does that come from? The shift is so abrupt that some wonder if possibly what we should picture here is the lamenter, David in this case, the one offering the prayer is praying to God before a priest. So you got two people. And only the words of only one of them are recorded. And so the prayer is expressing these complaints to God, and then almost that we should picture the priest reminding him of what is true. Yeah, but God has said this. Well, God is that for you. And the lamenter, in response to what has been said, affirming that, agreeing with that. Yes, but you are a shield about me. So possibly two people there, and the words of only one of them are recorded. Whether it's that or whether it is simply David is by himself and he is giving voice to all of his concerns and then he remembers something. He reminds himself of something else he knows is true, but I remember this as well. However it is, he's saying verses 1 and 2 are only part of the picture. And I remember, I know something deeper. In England in 1812, England was at war, of course, with the U.S. in 1812, also at war with France on the European continent. And long before, certainly smartphones and the internet, but any form of wired communication, they had the original wireless communication. They had a system of towers. And this set of towers was called the semaphore line. And it was designed that you could receive a message in any one of the cities that had a tower, and through a series of signals, you would relay it to the next tower, sort of like that great Lord of the Rings montage where they're passing the flame of fire the whole way around the country. But it was real, it was historical. They would pass on through a series of signals. The next tower would receive it, send their own signals, and through tower after tower, they could send a message before the days of any kind of phone or anything like that. They could send a message the length and breadth of England. It's just amazing. So in 1812, the British are at war, and the Duke of Wellington, English Duke, takes troops into battle against the French in Salamanca, Spain. He takes the British troops into battle, and the message gets back to Plymouth. Wellington defeated the French. He won. Wellington defeated the French at Salamanca. And so the captain in Plymouth, Captain Calder, receives the message, and he starts sending the signal onto the next tower to relay the news of the victory. Wellington defeated the French at Salamanca. But as he is sending the message, this deep, irrepressible fog rolls through. Thick, heavy fog, thick as clouds, rolls through, and the next tower could not receive the rest of the message. So there he is sending, Wellington defeated, and after that second word, the next tower could not receive anything else. So the only message they received was, Wellington defeated. That's it. You got to send on the message. They couldn't see anything else. They thought that was it. And so they relayed this two-word message, the length and width of England, Wellington defeated. And it was said when the news reached London, there was such hysteria, there was such panic, all hope is lost, that people went nuts. Mayhem. Businessmen began selling their government bonds. People started unloading their family fortunes, just scraping together whatever they could get. They said fortunes were lost. A few hours later, the fog finally lifted. And Captain Calder was able to send on the rest of the message. Wellington defeated the French at Salamanca. And now the news of victory goes throughout the entire country. And when the news reached London, panic turned to victory, turned to celebration and elation, people going nuts. That's the picture in Psalm chapter 3. It's the very same thing. I think that there's a spiritual fog in this world, is there not? We only see part of the picture, and then we must know, we must understand and remember there's more to it. God has not abandoned us. God is at work. There is salvation for the people of God. Get the rest of the message out. There will be confidence. We can have celebration. Now, very often in these Psalms, there is one key image that captures most of the theological freight of the chapter and then just conveys it in a single phrase. And this is it for Psalm chapter 3. Thou art a shield for me. What a picture. You want a great metaphor, a single image to capture the weight of the psalm? It's this one. You are a shield for me. Now, when do you use a shield? A shield is not a peacetime implement. You have a shield when there's a threat, when there's danger coming at you, but the shield protects you. Blows that would have fallen on you fall on the shield instead. Right? So it speaks of safety in the midst of uncertainty, thriving in the midst of threat. And additionally, the shield, often round in those days, but true whatever the shape, the shield covers its user. He says it is all about him, all around him. Very same idea. Enemies are all around me, but no, in fact, that's only part of the picture. I remember that God is all about me. God is all around me. That's the rest of the story. So the shape of the shield and the function of the shield communicate that God is with his people. Even in the midst of danger, preserving even in the midst of threat and hardship. It's way more powerful than if David had just said, I know you'll be with me. I know you'll protect me. No, you're a shield all about me. We might even possibly think of last week, gospel friendships and those images of ancient soldiers going into battle with their shields interlocking, covering one another. We need one another in this defense that we're to have. You are my shield. And then he says, you are my glory. You are the one, you are the lifter of my head. Now, what would give David that confidence? That's amazing. We'll get to a deeper level of that in just a minute. But what would give David that confidence? Well, for one, he has seen God's deliverance in the past. He has experienced God's salvation already in his own life. Verses 4 and 5. I cried aloud to the Lord. He answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept, and I got up again. I awoke because you sustained me. That the classic children's prayer. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. The reason why I got up is because you sustained me. Now, he might be thinking of one specific instance in the past, one specific night where he lay down and the threat was so close, he wasn't sure if he was going to wake up again. There's plenty of opportunities for a night like that in David's life. Right? But I laid down, the reason why I got up is because you kept me safe. You protected me. It might be a specific instance. It might be a general principle. Every single day he realizes, every single day that I lay down and sleep and I get up again, it's because you have been sustaining me. And that's true for your own life as well. Every day that you get up is because God has something more for you. And so it could be specific. It could be general. I think it's that as David is fleeing, he's run away, the army is chasing him. He lay down. He literally didn't know if he would wake up again or not. And the reason why he did is because he can say, he knows, God sustained me. Anytime you experience that kind of deliverance once, it gives you greater confidence going forward. And so in your own lives, have you seen God work? Have you experienced his provision at all? Are there moments you can point back to and say, I saw God move there. I can trust he'll move here, even if it's in a way that surprises me. It's so important to have moments like that. And yet for David as well as for us, there is something even greater than past deliverance to give us confidence going forward. Something even greater than just, I saw a few of these moments in my own life, and so I can trust him going forward. And you know what that is? David says, you are the glory and the lifter of my head. Now that is incredible. To have your head lifted is an expression of pride, right? I got my head is up. But to have somebody else be the lifter of your head is to know that you're down, right? You're discouraged, and somebody else comes along and says, no, lift up your head. We're going to keep moving. We're going to go on. There's somebody else who's a lifter of your head. They're encouraging you. They're affirming you. Now, how in the world can David say, God is the lifter of my head when I've been down? Think about his life. What has he done? He's committed adultery at this point. He's murdered the husband of the woman that he committed adultery with. He's an absolute failure as a king. He is on the run. His own people have rejected him. Can you imagine saying this prayer to God today? Oh God, I committed adultery. I've murdered. I have failed in every meaningful task you've given me. You think he's a good father? Look, his own son is trying to kill him. I failed in every meaningful task you've ever given me, but I know you are thrilled with me. I know you're proud of me. Where does he get the knowledge, the freedom and assurance to say that, to know that? And the answer is, he says, I know the Lord heard me from his holy hill. Now for David, that would have been where the tabernacle was. That would have been where the place of sacrifice took place. Likely for David, he would have gone back to Genesis 15 and Genesis 22. In Genesis 15, we preached on it last May, God says to Abram, do not fear. David says, I will not fear. Do not fear, I am your shield. And in Genesis 15, God is making his covenant with Abram. He says, take the animals, cut them in two, and then Abram never walks between the pieces, only God does. God is saying, you're going to mess it up, and I'm going to pay the price for you. Genesis 22, Abram goes up the mount, and the Lord provides the ram, the sacrifice, instead of Abram, and instead of Abram's son. He heard from his holy hill. David would have looked at the tabernacle on the hill and known that is the place of sacrifice where my sins are atoned for. They're transferred to this animal, this substitute, and I receive cleansing in return. You and I get to look to a much greater hill than that. A much greater hill of sacrifice. You and I get to look at David's son ascending Calvary and saying, you messed it up, and I will pay the price. I will walk through, and I will have your guilt transferred onto me, and I will have my righteousness, my acceptance transferred onto you. The Lord heard from his holy hill. When Jesus goes to that cross on Calvary, as we've said many times, the curtain in the temple was ripped in two. What was that? That was the barrier between us and God because of the sins that we have done. And he's saying that barrier is gone. God will now hear you through the work that I have done on the holy hill. You see, before we get to David's chorus, there are two other pieces of lament that he throws in there in verses 7 and 8. He does the call and he does the curse. Both arise out of verse 7. Arise, O Lord, that's the call. Save me, but also the cursing. For you save me, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Now, what do you do with that? I mean, very practically, are Christians supposed to pray those prayers? Are you allowed to pray those prayers? Somebody's coming at you. Your neighbor, your coworker, are you allowed to pray that? Well, I don't know that I can give it a definitive answer on that one way or the other. We wrestle with this, but here are just two little pieces. The one is, just notice, David is appealing to God for vengeance. He's not saying, I will do this. And that's a huge piece. Whatever concern he has, whatever desire for vengeance he has, I'm going to place this in your hand. And in fact, doing that is the only thing that frees you not to take vengeance yourself. So this type of praying is actually a means to being a peaceable person. I'm going to locate all these desires in you so that I don't do it myself. That's the first piece. But second, various authors have said, authors who have come from war-torn developing countries, they have said it is only possible to believe in or entertain certain ideas of no vengeance ever. That's only possible in the ivory-covered towers of modern suburbia, to mix metaphors. The ivory-covered towers of modern suburbia where everything is safe and nice. But these men coming out of war-torn developing countries, say if you ever face real evil in the flesh, if you ever face real devastation, you'll know what it is to cry out, will they ever be stopped? Put an end to it. Much as the martyrs in Revelation 5 in the first century AD and beyond. Just a few of the pieces. And yet, are you supposed to pray these prayers long term? I think we have a bit of a knee-jerk discomfort because we look back on great David prayed that prayer. His son, his greater son, prayed a different prayer. Father, many are rising up against me. Strike me to forgive them. Laments are all throughout the Bible, but some of the most poignant ones are on the lips of Jesus himself. Matthew 23, he wept over Jerusalem. It's a prayer of lamentation, Matthew 23. You get to the garden, and he prays great prayers of great sorrow in the garden. Look at what's rising up against me. Is there no other way? He laments from the cross. My God, invocation, why hast thou forsaken me? Complaint. Plea. And that he never called down a curse on his enemies, but looked out on them and said, forgive them, put the curse on me instead. You realize you're in that batch of enemies, and he prayed that for you? That's what'll change you so that you start not praying the same thing against your enemies as well. But I mean, very, very practically, the way to get to that point, as I said at the beginning, the way to get to that point is not to say, I recognize these desires for vengeance, just stuff it. I want to be holier than I am, so I'm just not going to give voice to that. No, if they're in there, you need to tell him about it. He already knows. You might as well process it with him. But also the way to get there is not just to start spouting off these vindictive things to other people. It's certainly not to take vindication into your own hands. But it's to say, God, oh God, I recognize this within me. I remember what your son did for me when I came against him. And so looking at that and in this confession bringing it to light, would you change my heart so that these types of things no longer bubble up from within? You're being changed through lamentation, through bringing your complaints and your concerns to God Almighty, letting the matter in his hand, having total confidence. Because you've seen that what he did through his son on the cross means even if you go through the worst in this life, even if things go into the pit, he brings out of the pit. Jesus Christ defeated, right? Cross, grave. For 2 days, the only news was Jesus Christ defeated. You know the rest of the story. Jesus Christ defeated death. He took the worst blow from the enemy and turned it around and brought victory out of it. Jesus Christ defeated the enemy. Know that and have confidence in Him no matter what you face. Let's pray together. Oh Lord, I pray, teach us to do the kind of lamenting that we find in the Bible. We confess today that so often our approach is either just trying to pretend like these negative feelings aren't there, or just wallowing in them as we talk about them to everybody else but You. And so I pray that beholding the prayers who pray in the Psalms, I pray teach us to bring our concerns and yes, even our complaints to You. And as we do, I pray it would not be a rebellious thing, but a humble, submissive, bringing into the light kind of thing. That You would remind us of the work of Your Son on the cross, that we would know You are a shield about me. You hear us from that holy hill, and You sustain us. And so in Christ, there is blessing for Your people. Yeshua, salvation, is of the Lord. Remind us of that today, we pray. In His name, amen.